Welcome to We Are Not Alone. We're local investigators, as well as world-renowned scientists and ufologists, share their latest evidence in support of the UFO reality. I'm David Twitchell, and you're listening to WHFR Dearborn. WHFR.FM is the station making waves, and for the next hour, we'll be exploring the mysteries of the UFO and abduction phenomenon. And our guest today is Mr. Bill Weber. Bill is a field investigator for MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network. And Bill supports MUFON through participation in their Pennsylvania State UFO conferences, and will be speaking there this October on the subject of UFOs and technology. And we'll talk more about that event a little later in the show. And Bill has been the state section director for the 13 counties representing southeastern Pennsylvania since January of 2010. And his background is in electrical engineering, where, as a designer, he holds 3 U.S. patents. And today we can pick his brain on the subject of UFOs and technology. So welcome to the show, Bill Weber.
Well, thank you, sir. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, we're glad to have you. You're going to be not Pittsburgh, but I'm getting them mixed up because they're both in Pennsylvania.
Right, Philadelphia.
You're going to be in Philadelphia, that's it. On the 15th, is that it?
Yes. There'll be 2 conferences held in Pennsylvania. One will be focused on the eastern side of the state, the East Coast Conference, and that one runs from October 15th and the 16th, which will be held over at the Sheraton Philadelphia Northeast. Mm-hmm. And then in parallel with that, or about a week or so after that conference, will be one favoring the western side of the state, which will be held over at Westmoreland Community College over in Youngwood, and that will be occurring on October 22nd and 23rd.
All right. Okay, well, give us a little teaser about what you're going to be talking about, UFOs and technology.
Well, I have a PowerPoint slide presentation that runs approximately about an hour and a half. And the presentation is essentially a subjective overview. I present the research that I've been digging into for a while, and I let the audience make their own evaluation of that material and come away with, do you believe it or not? Essentially, I start off with a brief history of the subject, going back into the 1930s with Germany, prior to the war, during the war, after the war, and then from that, where as a function of the war, some the Nazi scientists and their technology were taken both to the U.S. and also to Russia. And some things via technology improvements and or breakthroughs occurred rather quickly after that importation of these scientists.
Hmm. Okay, so yeah, I've heard a lot about a lot of these UFOs are really Nazi technologies, but then on the other hand, I've heard a lot of them were lucky to hover off the ground a little bit and they really didn't do much with them. What is your findings on that?
Well, I guess it all started in the 1930s, where there was an alleged UFO crash that took place in the Black Forest over in Freiburg, Germany.
Okay.
Essentially, that craft was taken to Wilhelmsburg Castle, and there it was reverse engineered. But along with this, there was some, I guess, Germany and specifically Hitler and his chain of command were very much involved in the occult.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, they had some spiritualists and also some others who kind of sort of were, through like telepathy sessions, were in contact with an alien race, if you would. And from that, those telepathy sessions and the reverse engineering, they were able to put together some craft. Both of these groups were either involved with what started out as the Tool Society, and then from there they started up on the Vril Society, and as a result there were several craft that were fabricated both early on with the Tool Society, and they named these craft the Hanabu series.
Hanabu meaning what?
The Vril Society. And then they had several, you know, several large craft that could reach incredible speeds and carry a crew of up to 8 to 10 crewmen. But again, this was all under the guise of Hitler trying to put together a wonder weapon to help him as the war was progressing against him.
Now, are these claims that they had these craft, or has this been shown to be true, or what?
Well, there's some stuff.
Because it seems to me if they had these craft, they probably would have won the war.
Well, the thing is, there were reports during the war of Foo Fighters that the Allied pilots had seen.
All right.
Flying alongside their aircraft, and they really didn't know what they were, and it's alleged that they could have been part of this space development program or craft development program.
Mm.
Now, there are also some top scientists there in Germany, one being a fellow by the name of Victor Schorberger, who came up with some anti-gravity propulsion experiments and such, and had developed a craft called the Repulsin. And essentially, he was tested back in 1940. This particular craft was like early attempts for anti-gravity.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Victor Schorberger was—he was brought into the U.S. and he was, debriefed, and a lot of his knowledge and stuff was kept here in the U.S. And he went back into Germany after a period of time, but he went back there broken, penniless.
Hmm.
So, but the information that he brought with him tended to stay here assisted in, some of the programs that we had.
Hmm.
And then also during that particular time, there was this thing that was called the Nazi Bell that was developed over in... close to a complex, it was in a complex close to the Wenceslas mine. Mm-hmm. Over in Poland. And this is, I'm sure you've seen this on television, where they show this thing that called the Henge. It looks like, in some people allege that it's a cooling tower, or was this a test rig? It's not to be, it's not been defined yet. However, in some books that are out there, like Joseph Farrell's book, he indicated that they found isotopes in the reinforcement construction of the Henge, which could only be the result of irradiation by a strong beam of neutrons.
Hmm.
So, in other words, there was some high radiation given off by some device that was inside that bell, if you would. The bell... looked like a bell, and it's strange because the sighting and the alleged craft recovery that occurred in Kecksburg, Pennsylvania, resembles that craft a mm-hmm. lot.
Well, so could Kecksburg have been kind of our experimentation with the bell?
Was Schorberger? Well, he came up with this device, which was the Repulsin, and again, it looked like an acorn-shaped type craft that he had put together.
Right.
Okay?
Hmm.
And again, could some of this research be some of the precursors to a program that I'm sure people have heard about called the Aurora Project? And, you know, there was a craft supposedly the code name is Astra, but it's the TR-3B that's developed under that program, and it's alleged to be over at Area 51. Now, don't forget, too, that during the war, a lot of the top scientists, as I mentioned, came over to the States under a project called Project Paperclip. And Wernher von Braun was one of those people that came over. And as we know, without him, we wouldn't have had a rocket program.
Right.
Because he was developing the rocket program over in Peenemünde, over on the Black Sea. And that's where he developed all the rockets, the V-1, V-2, that was pounding the heck out of
England, huh?
UK in London.
Yeah, I was going to say von Braun. He, Carol Rosen, that's her name, that was von Braun's secretary or left-hand man or right-hand man or something.
Right.
She said in the Disclosure Project, she said that von Braun told her then about alien beings and UFOs, that they were real, and they're back engineering them, and she didn't believe them, but then later she found out that this was true.
Well, again, with some of the things that were picked up when the U.S. came in, I think it was the 6th Army, I could be wrong,
okay,
came in... To Germany at the end of the war, I take that back. It was the America's Third Army that came in.
Mm-hmm.
All right, they had recovered pieces because there was a, I guess during the program when it was going on, it was eventually taken over by the SS, and they put together a program similar to our Project Blue Book.
Right.
That I believe was a major cover-up, because people see things and, you know, they've been alleged that, oh, it's swamp gas, it's balloons, it's Chinese lanterns, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, these things were not those objects as was alleged.
Mm-hmm.
And when the Third Army went in there, they recovered pieces of stuff that they brought back. And during that time, too, there was this one... flying wing that was being developed or had been developed and had been flying. It was the Horton 229, which I believe is there's pieces of it that were recovered that's over at the National Air and Space Museum. So that was a jet aircraft back in the 40s. So a lot of the stuff was there, and the evidence is there, but of course you and I will never know it or see it because of all of the cover-ups.
Right. I just got a report. I'm an investigator for Michigan MUFON.
Oh, very good.
And I just got a report from this guy whose wife had this sighting of a boomerang-shaped object. But it was hovering. And a lot of people say, oh, that was the flying wing. That's what they saw, as a flying wing. But this thing was hovering silently above, you know, right above the ground, or above the... light posts, and just sat there. She pulled her car over, stopped, and was staring at this thing, and then just shot right off, zipped right off into the horizon. I don't think that was our flying wing, do you?
It's hard to tell. Lately,
really?
The last couple of days, I don't know if you've seen, there's been some stuff released, I guess, or from DARPA. Have you seen that, Dave?
No.
Where we have this craft that looks like an arrowhead,
okay.
That is alleged to be flying along at 13,000 miles an hour.
Well, yeah, but not hovering, right?
Not hovering, right?
Huh.
Well, in an anti-gravity type scenario, essentially you can control the environment that the craft is in from either forward, backward motion, up and down. You could be hovering, you could be stationary on the ground, and then you could accelerate at very high rates of speed. Part of this Aurora program is they're saying that some of the technology that's involved in that are using anti-gravity principles, and they're able to reduce the effects of gravity by about maybe 85%.
What about inertia?
Because of the... reduction of the forces of gravity by 85%. The craft, the weight, and the occupants are all, their weight and such are also reduced by a factor of about 85%. So as a result, what could be ridiculous G-forces, okay, at speeds like Mach 9, you know, maybe have the same effect on the body as like maybe Mach 1 or Mach 2. So the inertial effects wouldn't be as disastrous as you would think.
So why don't we have this craft over in the Middle East? I got you there, didn't I?
Yes. Again, you know, who knows? It might be over there spying on them.
It could be. It could be. And they're, and they're, they'd be saying, they'd be reporting UFOs, right?
Well, you know, at anything else, this country is always based on it. You know, if you take a look at the background of the U.S. and the technology that's come forth, there's a lot of stuff that has been developed like 20 years or so ago, and it's just starting to make its way out now.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so they're not going to open up their kimono 100% to show everybody, look what we got.
So, while we're on that subject, you as an investigator are in the Pennsylvania area, what percentage would you say of your reports remain as unknown, as opposed to those that you can probably qualify as a conventional object, a natural phenomenon, or hoax?
Right. Right. I'd say anywhere between 15 and 20%.
Really? That's,
yeah.
That's high.
That is high. But again, take a look at, again, well, you're with MUFON, so you know this. Well, last year, just between January 1st of 10 and January 1st of 11, there were over, like, almost 5,700 reports of sightings worldwide. And right within the U.S. alone, there was like 4,900 of them. Now, Pennsylvania made up about 5% of that U.S. total.
Whoa.
For about 244 cases.
Mm-hmm.
And of those cases, they were classified anywhere, as what we call, there are four classifications. There's the ANs, or anomalies. There's the MAs, or the maneuver. They see something maneuvering around. There are flybys. And then, of course, there's the CEs, the close encounters.
Right.
And, you know, those represented those 240-some-odd cases that we had there. Yeah, there's a lot of stuff that, again, that I've researched and my team of field investigators have researched, and some of it is identifiable. It could be a star. It could be meteors. It could be known aircraft and such. But then again, there's other stuff that has been showing up on some radar tracks that we don't know what it is. There's people seeing things or having experience that they may want to go into like a regression hypnosis session to figure out what really happened to them, because I have a case that I was working on that, well, I swear to God, is a is an abduction. But
as
you have to be very sensitive to those type cases, as you know.
Has the subject been hypnotized?
No, I'm trying to get her together. I'm trying to get the witness together with Dr. David Jacobs, but he's incredibly busy.
Oh, yeah. You know what? We just had Dr. Jacobs on the show last month.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, he. I know him personally. We've done presentations together at our UFO awareness days. He's been one of the guest speakers. And people come down to these things not to listen to me, but to listen to Dr. Jacobs, you know.
Right.
And, yeah, he's written some books, and some of them are pretty interesting. Like one of them is called The Threat. I don't know if you read that.
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, that's
kind
pretty
of scary.
Scary.
I was just going to say, very scary.
Yeah.
But I don't know if, you know, I always say, and I may be wrong, I've been wrong at least once in my life.
But then you were wrong.
But yeah, but I was mistaken at the time.
Yes.
So, At any rate, I always say there are good people, there are malevolent people, benevolent people, and indifferent people all over the world. Why should it be any different throughout the galaxy? You know?
I agree. And you have to stop and think, and I think this is one of the things like Linda Moulton Howe always says is, you know, all right, we're aware they're here. There's enough evidence and proof that they're here, but what we don't know is why they're here.
Right.
What's the agenda?
Right. So, we just don't know. I'm going to have to take just a minute here just to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the only station making waves here in Dearborn out of Henry Ford Community College. And you're listening to We Are Not Alone. And I'm David Twitchell, and we're speaking with Mr. Bill Weber. I want to take this opportunity as well to tell you about the Pennsylvania Conference, October 15th and 16th, 2011, just in case you're listening to the archives in 2013 or something. And Mr. Bill Weber will be speaking there, the 15th and 16th, that conference, as well as George Filer. George Filer and I got together with him on authored a book called Filer's Files, Worldwide Reports on UFO Sightings. And so George Filer will be there. I won't be there at that time, but he will. Bill Burns, you know, the UFO Hunters, History Channel's UFO Hunters, and UFO Magazine, Bill Burns. And John Ventra, who will be our guest for the October show of We Are Not Alone. John Ventra is the state director for Pennsylvania. He'll be speaking there on October 15th and 16th. And Linda Moulton Howe, the author of A Strange Harvest. And Linda will be our guest here on We Are Not Alone on the November show. So we got to kind of get them lined up there. And that's the 15th and 16th of October. And that is at 9661 Roosevelt Boulevard in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And you can get information on that at area code 215-671-9600. And you can also go to pamufon.com. I'm sorry, mufonpa.com. Don't get that mixed up. mufonpa.com. MUFONPA.com. Then on October 22nd and 23rd, Stanton T. Friedman. Stanton Friedman will be speaking in Pittsburgh. And Bill Burns also, and John Ventra, William Konkoleski. Bill Konkoleski is the state director for Michigan, and of course, yours truly, I will be speaking there on the 22nd, 23rd of October 2011. That's at the Westmoreland Community College at 145 Pavilion Lane in Youngwood, Pennsylvania. That's 145 Pavilion Lane in Youngwood, Pennsylvania. And you get information by calling 724-925-4000. That's 724-925-4000. Go to MUFONPA, MUFONPA.com for information on the two events and registration information. And I hope to see some of our listeners there. And right now we're going to get back to speaking with Mr. Bill Weber. We're now hearing a band playing. Can you hear that band, Bill?
Yeah, I can hear drummers.
Well, you know, this is supposed to be a soundproof booth. What's happening? You know?
Well, that's a perfect segue. What a wonderful way to segue right into our program.
Yes, a little drum roll, please.
There you go.
Here is... Bill Weber.
Ta-da.
Hey, you like that? That was good, right?
I do. I like that. That's good.
Well, we'll be hearing that. They're going on another show, so they're tuning up. Believe it or not, I've got the door closed here. Anyway, back to the show.
Yeah.
The late Colonel Philip Corso wrote a book entitled The Day After Roswell, where he claims to have divvied out some of the Roswell crash wreckage to private industry, which would account for much of our recent technologies. How much of this do you feel is true?
Well, what's the best place to hide something is in plain sight.
True.
And it's alleged that quite a bit of material was recovered from that crash at Roswell during 1947. the metal that was retrieved is alleged to have gone to a Battelle. Some of the components that were there had gone out to AT&T Bell Labs. Now, you have to understand that during that particular time, AT&T was under contract with the government, so here's a better place to, a nice place to hide some stuff.
Mm.
But during the 40s and such, just think back, again, I'm not certain the age of your listeners or what age they span, but radios used to have these stupid things that burned your fingers when you touched them. They were called vacuum tubes.
Mm-hmm.
And soon after that, the crash in Roswell in 47 was the invention of the transistor, which has replaced the vacuum tube in almost everything that we see today.
Right.
Some of the other material that was uncovered there, they said they found these things that looked like spaghetti, but they were able to transmit light. And soon after, like in 1954. Fiber optics were developed, and and then in 1958, Texas Instruments came out with this thing that they referred to as a integrated circuit. And if you recall in that book, David, there were some boards that had some things on it that looked like chips that he wasn't sure what they were.
Right.
But again, this technology could have been divvied up and given out to industry where, A, it can be protected under either trademark or under patent protection, and no matter what, you don't have any rights to go in and explore that technology if it's protected by patent. So again, if this is stuff that was gleaned from that crash and divvied out to industry, what a better place to hide it, because if it's in the government, somebody can, especially today under Freedom of Information, you can go back and maybe pull out some of this stuff. But if it's property of a corporation, it's pretty hard to dig into it.
Well, how much of this technology do you feel probably has been back engineered by our military/government? And is in use now?
Oh, there's a lot of stuff that's in use now. I mean, just
other than the things that you mentioned, but I mean, possibly has been back engineered but hidden away.
Right. Well, I'm sure that the material that was recovered has been researched and also has been looked upon on how to introduce it into our daily lives, if you would, and also perhaps part of our defense programs, part of our space programs.
Hmm.
And some of the material, like they said, I think it was reported on a number of different shows that the son of the rancher said his father brought home a piece of metal and he crumbled it all up in his hands and he kind of sort of opened his hands up and the metal just uncrumbled back to the shape that it began.
Right.
Well, in 1960, nitinol or memory morphing metal alloy was invented.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so this is something that you could start with a predetermined shape and crimple it all up, and under like a heating condition or such, it returns back to that original shape.
Mm-hmm.
All right, now this is technology that we use today.
Right.
And again, fullerenes and buckyballs, okay, that's another, it's a molecule that basically is composed primarily of carbon. And from this technology, we've developed and came out with the latest buzzword, I guess, that everyone has heard is called nanotubes and nanotechnology.
Right.
And okay. That type of technology is being used for a number of different things as far as lightweight and strength. It could be coatings on aircraft. The coatings on stealth fighters, like the 117, that's alleged to come from what was gleaned from alien technology.
Okay. But where is the proof on that?
Who knows?
You know, Stan Friedman doesn't believe that Corso was straightforward on this, doesn't think that a lot of what he put in his book was true. I mean, he didn't think that he had that that in with the technologies. How would you answer Stanton on that?
Well, again, just take a look at like I started with the vacuum tube scenario, where you know we were developing for a long period of time. We were perfectly happy to go along with the technology that we had. Okay, more and more products are coming out with vacuum tubes, so on and so forth. Then all of a sudden, during a short period of time, there were some major breakthroughs in technology. Now, you know, again, I would debate that, like, well, how can, you know, is it a coincidence that everybody's working on different things and the breakthroughs are occurring within, like, 10, 15 years span?
Right, right.
You know, somewhere along the line, we had to have an edge or a help or somebody pointing us saying, look at it this way, you know, thinking out of the box, perhaps.
Well, I had heard that we had, there goes those drums again. I had heard that we were already working on some of these things, like night vision and that type of thing before 1947. Is it the case that we were? And we just, you know, that's completely our technology? Or is it the case that we were working on it, we had the idea of it, but then all of a sudden Roswell happens and we have a little helping hand?
Well, I don't think it all necessarily came from Roswell. After the war, like I said, these German scientists and stuff that supposedly, like you indicated, Dave, that von Braun said that we had help, okay?
Right.
Essentially, we wanted to get them, and we wanted to get them over here, okay? And we wanted to pick their brains because at that time, you know, it was known that they were like maybe 10 years ahead of us in technology, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And look how quickly from the time that we brought them over here, like especially under that guise of Project Paperclip, that our space program took off.
Right.
Okay? So, again, were we working on it? Perhaps we were. Were we painting ourselves into a corner and didn't have the right algorithms at that time or the right solutions? And maybe by bringing some of these scientists over or reverse engineering, we were able to say, oh, okay, I didn't think of it that way.
They just had those other denominators that we did not have. Huh?
Perhaps. Perhaps. I mean, and I don't know if we'll ever know,
right,
to be honest with you,
right,
because of, you know, a lot of stuff is hidden under the veil of black projects, and God only knows how much money is spent on black projects.
Oh,
I think,
man,
you know, we're worrying about our economy now, you know, and you think that money's going some places, but is it really going to where we think it is?
Oh, they admit, Congress admits that there's monies that are, you know, I'm putting this money out, and I don't know where the heck it's going, and but don't tell me, because I don't want to know.
I don't want to know.
And that's
right.
It. They don't want to know. And don't worry, they're not going to tell them.
This is true.
And they say, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Exactly.
But, yeah, millions, billions every year.
No question that there's major funds being allocated for black projects.
Right.
And, again, now, you know, it's funny. Like, they say, oh, well, the government is cooperating right now under, again, the guise of freedom of information. But the information that they're telling us is from programs that were back in the 60s. Like, oh, okay, we'll tell you now all about the Blackbird. Well, Jeezel, you know, we know about the Blackbird. It's the stuff that came after the Blackbird that we're interested in.
Right. It's like they're claiming that Roswell was the Mogul balloon. This is after they said, oh, it was a disc. No, it was a weather balloon. No, it was a Mogul balloon. But the Mogul balloon, when they said this was a top secret Mogul balloon, they had already talked about, you know, exposed this top secret Mogul balloon years ago. Why didn't they say so, you know, years ago?
Well,
you know what I'm saying?
Again, it's under the guise of, you know, secrecy. Now, there's another school of thought out there that the craft that crashed in Roswell might have been a German craft. Hmm. And some of the craft that we're seeing now could be a combination of technology gleaned from the Germans combined with our stuff, like, you know, some of the Bob Lazar was saying, you know, like that craft there. Now, was that theirs or was that ours?
Okay, German craft. Now, they got from Germany. Let's look at this geographically. They got from Germany, from the east, all the way over to New Mexico without being spotted. Well, was everybody asleep here or what? You know what I'm saying? Or were they already here? Or are you saying that we were working on German technology and testing it?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
In other words, reverse engineering what we got.
Okay. I see what you're saying. Okay.
And then again, you're saying, well, you know, they got from Germany or East Germany all the way over to here without being detected. Look at what happened at Pearl Harbor.
Yeah, well, that was across the ocean, right?
Yeah, but again, they detected it, but they downplayed it.
I know, and that's the scary thing and it was right after 9/11. I'm kind of getting off on a different track here, but now that you mention it, it's a good segue. at least we'll claim that you mentioned it. it right after 9/11, they came out with this story about FDR knew that this attack was going to happen, and he wanted to get involved in the Second World War, but the American people did not want to, and so he just let the Pearl Harbor attack occur, knowing that the people would back him now. And right. I thought, why are they showing us that now? You know what I'm saying?
Well, it's the same thing, like, just... I have my own theory, and I'm sure you do too, about what's going on today, okay?
Mm-hmm.
First off, like I said earlier in this program, that in the year of 2010, there are over 5,700 sightings worldwide, okay? A lot of people are coming forward now. A lot of people are saying, hey, I'm not buying this stuff that this is swamp gas or balloons or whatever, okay? There's something out there.
Right.
And, but during the time in the early periods of time during like Project Blue Book or the Condon Report and all of this stuff, where during the 50s when there were some flaps going on around the country, they were played very played down, and people were ridiculed and such. And again, a lot of people's careers were ruined because they came forward and said, hey, I seen this thing out there.
Definitely.
I don't know what it is.
Yeah.
And, of course, their careers were ruined. Their reputations were ruined. This guy's a nut, you know. And so people kept things to themselves.
Right.
But now we're seeing more and more people coming forward. And if you think about it for a moment, just the last 10, 15 years, I think we're being preconditioned right now, Dave. They're, you know, at some point, somebody's going to make an announcement that they're here, you know. Yeah. And but I think we're being preconditioned with what's going on in Hollywood, the movies, the specials on TV, you know, the UFO hunters, Ancient Aliens, and all those programs that are on Discovery and History Channel. A lot of people are watching that. And so if somebody was to say, hey, they're here, you know, they won't be, oh, okay, well, we figured that, you know,
yeah.
as opposed to, like, during broadcast of the War of the Worlds where people were jumping out of windows.
Right. Well, a lot of my guests say the same thing. I agree with them, but I go one step further and say I think they're allowing, when I say they, the government, the powers that be, I should say, are allowing these stories and secrets to leak out because pretty soon they don't have to announce it. It will be self-evident.
I believe you. I believe you.
Yeah. So I need to take one more break just to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the only station making waves. You're listening to We Are Not Alone. I'm David Twitchell, and we're speaking with Mr. Bill Weber of Pennsylvania MUFON. And tell us a little bit about Pennsylvania MUFON. What do you do? What does MUFON do? And how do people check this out?
Okay. Well, MUFON, I call it MUFON. MUFON. Yeah,
Some people call it muffin.
Okay. Well, MUFON started back in 1969, and it was several gentlemen had started the organization back in I believe it was in Illinois, and then the first director back in 69 was Dr. Alan Yucky, I think his name is.
I can't help you there.
Or Yucky.
Okay.
And then essentially what he did is he stayed with the program as the director, but then as time went on, one of the co-founders of the organization was Walter Andrus, and he became the international director in 1970. Now, MUFON itself is an acronym that stands for Mutual UFO Network. And essentially, the mission statement of MUFON that we all have tattooed on us is the scientific study of UFOs for the benefit of humanity.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially, what our goals are is we investigate UFO sightings, and we've came up with a classification of these types of sightings that witnesses are seeing. And we start with essentially the witness reports and investigate to try to put that to closure as to what it is that people are seeing. Our second goal is that we tend to go out and promote the research on this. We want to really know what the true nature of the phenomena is, and then maybe take a look at that in the guise of what can we possibly glean from them as far as scientific breakthroughs and improving our life here on our own planet.
Mm-hmm.
We want to educate the public, and in so doing, we do have several things that we do. We have our annual UFO symposium. We have a very nice journal that comes out every month that talks about a number of different subjects. One, of course, is worldwide sightings, okay, and reports of sightings not only here in the U.S. but all over. And then essentially with these programs, we tend to, because we're a nonprofit organization, we need to raise money somehow. So we try to get a little bit of money to keep MUFON alive and well so that we can continue in our mission. We've gone through a number of different people at the helm of our ship. Like I said, Walter Andrus in the 70s, and then he turned it over to John Schussler, I guess around the 2000 time frame, and then in 06, it was picked up by Mr. James Carrion, and then today, currently in 2010, it was picked up by Clifford Clift as our international director, and MUFON is a worldwide organization. Now, in the United States, each state is broken into pieces. There's one director for each state, and we call him the state director, obviously. In Pennsylvania, his name is John Ventry. Now, alongside of him is a what we call a chief investigator, who essentially is a senior investigator and has a lot of case history behind him. And then there is, under him, is a state section director, where the state is broken up like a pie, if you would. Pennsylvania has five regions, and I happen to be a state section director for what we call Region 2, Southeastern PA, which represents 13 counties here in Pennsylvania. Now, under me, in a supervisory-type scenario, is a team of field investigators. I myself am a field investigator, and we had to study and take tests to become that, and then work as a junior investigator under the wing of either a state section director or a chief investigator until we gained enough knowledge to be turned loose on our own. Mm-hmm. Now, myself, I have over 60 cases under my belt since I became a field investigator many years ago. Mm-hmm. And another one of the duties that I do is, you know, I can basically initiate some case assignments, and I monitor their progress, and I work hand-in-hand with my team of field investigators. And like I said, depending on the caseload, sometimes I'll, go out there and function as a field investigator myself in cases in my own general area.
Right.
Now, I started out as a journal subscriber, but then, and a lot of people can do that. You don't have to be a field investigator. If you have an interest in the subject, you can join MUFON. You'll get a monthly journal, and then you can see what's going on. If you have more interest, like I did, and I'm sure David did, you'll dig into it a little bit more. You'll obtain the field investigator's manual, study it, and take the test, and then you start on your pathway.
And this is a non-profit organization.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
It's a, I believe it's a 501c.
Okay. Well, to me, that means non-profit organization.
Yeah, to me, it means non-profit organization.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
So a lot of it is with contributions and the events that we sponsor, whether there are these conferences that we do here in Pennsylvania or UFO Awareness Days. We get invited to other functions as a guest speaker. I've been invited to a couple.
Mm-hmm.
And it's good because, again, it's public awareness. Make people know or let people know what's really going on out there. And
right.
Not to think that we're not affiliated with the government. We're not the men in black. We're
really
not going to show up in front of your house with a black car. all we want to do is we want to understand what it is that people are seeing and reporting.
Right. Now, like you say, 80%, 80 to 90% are of these sightings turn out to be explainable, earthly phenomena, natural phenomena, conventional objects. Hoaxes are like 1% or 2%, wouldn't you say?
It depends what area of the country you're in, Dave.
Ah.
Okay, in some areas, for lack of a better definition, there are there's more people out there that I'm trying to be politically correct.
Okay,
know?
I see. We won't mention any states or cities or
any.
But you know who you are.
Diagnosis of these people.
You know who you are, folks.
Yeah. You can run, but you can't hide.
That's it. We know who you are too, and I've been caught believing in somebody's hoax before, but we all have. But it's that old "fool me once, shame on you; fool me twice, shame on me" thing. It's getting easier. The more experienced you become as an investigator, it becomes easier to detect who is trying to hoax you and who is not. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah. I mean, when somebody calls up and says, there's a green man in my backyard and he's throwing rocks at the house, okay, I'll listen to him, all right? And but then, when the story changes like 10 minutes later, okay, then you know that that there's something fishy going on. But unfortunately, as the case might be, and I'm sure you'll admit to this too, every time that somebody sees something, no matter what it is, okay, and if they file a report, the report goes to our international headquarters in Colorado. From there, it's cataloged. There's case numbers assigned to it, and then it's assigned to the state all the way down to the typical field investigator. And we have to go out and spend the time to research it and figure out what it is. We just cannot dismiss it.
That's
right. And there's a lot of time spent running around looking at these hoaxes that could be spent on doing some really in-depth research on something that could be real.
How much of that hoaxing business do you think is done by not the government, but the black ops, you know what I'm saying?
The disinformation group
to just try to make us chase our tails, waste our time, and throw up our hands and say, this is not worth it, you know?
Well, they won't hear me do that, okay? And they won't hear my team do that,
throw up our
hands, because we're dedicated, and I'm sure your team is as well.
Yeah, but it's frustrating, right?
It's very frustrating. Yeah it is. And this is, you know, some of the witnesses, even though they file a report, and then we have, normally we make contact within 24 to 36 hours to the witness that files the report to get together and maybe even have a face-to-face with them and go out and see what they saw or investigate, go in and start investigating.
Right.
And a lot of people at that point in time are afraid to meet us. We have to kind of sort of say, look, I'm not affiliated with the government. You know, I drive a Subaru. It's not a black car, you know. I do have my equipment, and above all, I have my identification with me, so I'll show you. A funny story happened, and I'll share this with you if I may.
Sure.
I was working with my senior field investigator up around Allentown, Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, which is northeast of the city of Philly. And I had on my nice golf shirt that had MUFON right on it, and I had my, you know, a pair of black slacks. My shirt was black, okay? I think you know where this is going.
Pretty much.
My senior field investigator had on his T-shirt that says, we investigate what others don't, you know, that one. It's identified as a MUFON-type shirt that he was wearing, and that also was black. We interviewed the witnesses and stuff, and on the way back home, we saw the state police barracks, so we stopped in the state police and introduced ourselves and such, and were invited in, and we spoke in the squad room to several officers and had given them our ID in case anybody, and business cards, and if anybody had any reports for them to have a place to contact. I think it was 2 days later I had heard that the men in black are running around up in Bethlehem and Allentown. This is no lie. In fact, I received a couple of emails, and I had a laugh about that, you know. But as when I saw it, I was dressed in a suit with black hat, black glasses, and I had an attaché case, okay?
Oh, man.
And so did my senior investigator.
We used to play a game as kids called rumor.
Yes.
And you'd whisper something to somebody, and then they'll whisper it to the guy next to them, and they'll whisper it to the gal next to them, and see how after about 10, 20 people, what the story is when it reaches the last person.
Or got back to you.
Yeah, and got back to me. And it does not resemble anything of the way it started.
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, you know, and you have to laugh. But this is what precipitates people, you know, like, I just don't understand. If the people spend the time to file a report, let's say, and then when we call to investigate, they fall off the planet.
Yeah.
Right? And it's very frustrating. I had a multiple signing over here in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. And, in fact, I was contacted by the local newspaper because a lot of people saw this. We almost called in the STAR team.
Hmm.
And for your audience, the STAR team is basically, it's a team of, like, senior investigators, STARS is an acronym, stands for like a Strike Team Area Research. And this team can be mobilized within 24 hours to go anywhere in the country for specific events, like a mini flap or whatever, or like a landing, or classifications, like anything over CE1, I believe, or I'm sorry, CE3. But in any event, all of these people came forward, and a local newspaper contacted me and said, hey, you know, what's going on? And we chatted, and I contacted all of these witnesses, and trying to get together with them for face-to-faces, forget it. It was, so everything, Bob had to call off. He was very close to calling in the STAR team.
But then you lost all your witnesses, huh?
I lost all my witnesses. They don't respond. I mean, after sending multiple emails and attempting phone calls, if they don't want to talk to me, I can't handle that rejection, you know?
Yeah. I just can't handle the rejection.
I can't handle it.
Yeah, that happens to me. You know, I'll get an assignment or a report, and I'll call the person and leave a message to call me back because I want to follow up on your report. I never hear from them again. I can only go by what is written on the report. You know, I can't tell if the person is sincere or just pulling a chain or what, because, you know, so if our listeners have filed a UFO report, please follow up on it. I'm not going to bite you. Just talk to me here, okay?
Right. Again, it's very frustrating because you're trying... See, what the listeners don't understand is that these reports are all compiled, completed, hopefully completed, and put into a major database that's used by the research community. Now, if you want to remain anonymous, you can. I mean, you know, your secret's safe with us, if you would, okay? We're not going to tell anybody, oh, by the way, this is Joe Smith and he lives down 221 Main Street, okay? We're not going to say that stuff. What we're going to say is, okay, there is a witness, all right, he wants to remain anonymous. This is what he saw. This is what I think he saw. And we put it in a database. And then we look for similarities across the country and across the world based on, you know, doing searches in that database to try and find similarities.
Right. What is a website where we can go to check out more of your work and MUFON's work?
Okay. Well, MUFON or MUFON, obviously the main website is www.mufon.com. Hmm. If you want to look at Pennsylvania, it's www.mufonpa.com, and my email address is on there. We have a listing of all of the state section directors. Our chief investigator and our state director is listed right on there with our contact information. If anyone wants to contact me via email, I'd be more than happy to chat with them.
Okay. Mr. Bill Weber, thank you very much for joining us. And I hope to see you soon in October. And,
yeah, I hope to see you out there, Western PA.
It'd be great, and I hope to see our listeners, too. Thanks again for joining us, Bill. We got to run.
Thank you, sir.
Okay. And if our listeners have any questions or comments for me, you can email me at dtwitchell@hotmail.com. And this show, as well as all the forum shows, is now archived at whfr.fm's website. Click on the forum button on the homepage. We Are Not Alone is also archived at my website, ufoimplications.com. And stay tuned to WHFR.FM, the station making waves, for the best in alternative programming. And I want to thank you for joining us today. Please join us again the first Tuesday of each month at 1 p.m. when we will again explore the mysteries of the UFO phenomenon. And until then, this is David Twitchell reminding you to keep an eye on the sky.
Arthur C. Clarke once observed, two possibilities exist. Either we are alone in the universe, or we are not. Both are equally terrifying. Join your host, David Twitchell, the first Tuesday of each month at 1 p.m., when he and special guests examine the scientific evidence on We Are Not Alone. Right here on WHFR.FM 89.3. That's the first Tuesday of each month at 1 p.m. We are not alone.
This is Pat 1054, and this is WHFR.FM, the station making waves.
My name is Jamali Rashears, and this is how I live United. Education has been so important in my life, but lots of kids in my community don't have the same opportunities. I'm an advocate and fundraiser for my local United Way. I help promote academic achievement and give kids a reason to stay in school. We also put together events to raise funds and bring our message to the kids that need to hear it most. My name is Jamali Rashears. I don't just wear the shirt, I live it.
Give, advocate, volunteer. Live United. Go to liveunited.org. Brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
Henry Ford Community College and Oakwood Healthcare are proud sponsors of the 2011 Dearborn Farmers and Artisan Market. The Dearborn Farmers and Artisan Market is open Fridays from 8 a.m. to 1 p.m. now through October 28th and is located next to the Bryant Library on Michigan Avenue in West Dearborn. For more information, call 313-673-4207. That's 313-673-4207. Or visit online at www.dearbornfarmersartisansmarket.com.
WHFR Dearborn.
This is an official station of the MAEB. The Michigan Association of Educational Broadcasters was formed in 1977 to support your local high school and college radio stations. These stations serve the community and create alternative programming. But most importantly, they discover and train the next generation of broadcasters. For more information on the MAEB and its affiliates, visit www.maeb.org.
Midnight Tuesdays, midnight to two, give your love and the blues. On the station, making waves, give your love and blues. Late night Tuesdays, the circle within. WHFR.FM 89.3. Blues on FM airwaves, a place to be.
Who? The Diva. What? Lyrical infusion. Where?